Caribou Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Create and Celebrate, a night celebrating Black creativity and power on Wednesday, February 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Grant High School Auditorium in Portland. Create and Celebrate is a showcase of young Black creative talent, including performances of poetry, dance, and music from students across Portland. Again, that's Create and Celebrate, a night celebrating Black creativity and power on Wednesday, February 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Grant High School Auditorium, 2245 Northeast 36th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There's no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kbu.org, all one word, or message us on Instagram at @PACUnderground.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Attorney General William Barr reduces the sentence proposed for Roger Stone today.
Another principal resigns from a Portland high school.
And in international news, climate hypocrisy in the EU.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 12th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Leo Lawyer, Cleveland High School's third principal in 4 years, has resigned after 7 months on the job. Lawyer replaced Aisha Freeman, who requested a transfer to Wilson High School after staff held a vote of no confidence in her leadership following a series of racist incidents at Cleveland. Serving as principal for the rest of the year will be Paul Cook, who retired from Cleveland in 2015 after being the principal there for 12 years. Cleveland was one of the three Portland high schools to post a drop in graduation rates from 2018 to 2019 and is targeted for major renovations in the school board's proposed $1.4 billion construction bond. The Portland School District started this academic year with 24 new principals.
The Oregon Court of Appeals has ruled that Secretary of State Bev Clarno acted improperly by rejecting three proposed ballot measures dealing with environmental protections last year. A three-judge panel concluded that Clarno misinterpreted state law when she tossed the proposals. They also found that a Marion County judge had been wrong in agreeing with the secretary in the matter. Environmental and labor groups, along with Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, have all opposed Clarno's interpretation of the proposals. The three initiative petitions were led by the conservation group Oregon Wild. All three proposed new policies for forest management in the state, including regulations on clear cutting, limiting the aerial spraying of pesticides, and new rules for a board overseeing the Department of Forestry. Clarno rejected all three measures in September, saying they did not meet the constitutional requirement that ballot measures only deal with a single subject. The Oregon Court of Appeals cited past Supreme Court cases that gave leeway to initiative petitions in meeting the single subject rule. The appeals court remanded the case back to Marion County and directed a judge there to enter an opinion in favor of the measure's petitioners.
Beaverton City Council voted on Monday to add a major change to the city's governmental structure on the May ballot. KBOO's own S.J. Oxendine spoke with Razia Roshan, Amy Johnson, and John Duggar of Beaverton about the new measure Beaverton residents may be surprised to see on the ballot in May.
Razia Roshan.
Please give a synopsis of your presentation this evening.
Yeah, so as a Beaverton resident and a property owner here, we're talking about the charter change. We currently have a strong mayor system. I'm in favor of a charter change. I think that what this does is it puts in a city manager that can ultimately oversee staff. Right, so when we're talking about the city of Beaverton and its expansive growth in population as well as development, we're talking about a city manager who can oversee that and focus on the staff level to know that the staff are taking care of all of our 200,000 citizens, I think is what we're getting close to. I think that one of the concerns that came up was making sure that the citizens have enough information before this goes on the ballot. And we do have a number of out streams that we can utilize that, in the discussions earlier, they've utilized a number of these streams. So we've had some wonderful feedback from the community as so far.
Well, how come people are... One of the biggest complaints that I keep hearing is there's not enough outreach and there's not enough people that know what's going on. How do you answer to that problem?
I think that Laura Mitchell had a great answer to that. And one is that it is hard to ask people to take a break from their busy lives, to ask, in particular, tonight's meeting starts at 6:30, and a lot of people are still getting off work. However, they have done some open sessions, and I know that some of our counselors have been out in the community talking about it. And we had one speaker who is a vice chair on one of the local NACs, and the NACs are one of the ways that I find about information in all the different pocket areas of Beaverton, is utilizing the Neighborhood Association Commissions because they know everybody within their kind of districts as well. So my feeling about it is that there have been a lot of really great voices in the room, and no matter how many people you tell something exists, there will always be 3,000 other people who didn't know it existed.
Okay, so be a little specific for people. Mm-hmm. What is the big deal difference between having a council and a mayor and a council and a manager?
So the council itself is still an elected body, and they will still oversee budgetary, you know, approvals and things of that nature. Obviously, other kind of inner workings where money is being exchanged or major transitions to infrastructure. What we're talking about is a strong mayor situation where the mayor, as a seat, oversees all the understaff working and can also have not ultimate power, but at least has a larger sway when it comes to changing policy. When we look at a city manager run city, we're talking about a staff person who then oversees staff people. So the mayor is still an elected official, just doesn't have as much time spent working in the staff underworkings. So it's still a very powerful position. One of the comments that was said earlier was taking power away from the mayor. No, it's
yeah, they complain that you're making it more of a ceremonial position.
The kissing babies thing.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's not all or nothing, really. What you're doing is you're changing the power dynamic, but there's still a lot of strength in the mayor's position itself and the way that the mayor works with the council. And that the way the mayor is still going to be out in the community, the way that a strong mayor is, out in the community, being present, listening, making sure that other connections are made as well. So that's still the role of the mayor no matter what.
And you, sir, are?
I am John Duggar.
Okay.
A resident of Beaverton and a candidate for city council.
It's not so much the subject that you have a problem with. It's the process about it, the way that it's being done, and there's not enough people being notified and included as to the changes that are about to take place.
Exactly, 100%. There's nothing burning that requires this change to happen right now, certainly not in May. Particularly when 11 people in a city of 100,000 have spoken on the issue. That is not enough. It should be 10 times, minimum, 10 to 100 times more than that.
And then I'll say personally, I am nervous about having someone who's quote-unquote a professional city manager being the one who's in charge rather than the person who we elect, because say we elect someone who we agree with the values, and they're, we want them to be able to have changes and to have real influence in the city, and then their hands are really tied because of this new form of government that we are creating.
So my name is Amy Johnson.
Again, I can see some of my, like, rationale behind trying to make sure that there's not some corrupt person who takes over the city, but at the same time, like, there's, I just don't see that it's necessary, or like, you couldn't end up with someone who's a corrupt city manager, which we did have happen before.
We have a very diverse community here. I've seen very little people of color here. I've seen very little from our large immigrant communities. Those voices are important, and they're often marginalized and not included, and we need to do better. We need to include everyone. And it's harder, I understand that. It takes more time, but that makes it so much more credible and so much more robust.
That was KBOO's S.J. Oxendine speaking with several Beaverton residents about an upcoming ballot measure this May.
A federal appeals court has backed a lower court's dismissal of a lawsuit against an Oregon school district's policy that allows transgender students to use locker rooms and bathrooms of the gender they identify with. In 2017, some parents and students at a high school in Dallas, Oregon, filed a lawsuit saying the policy caused stress and embarrassment. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, quote, "We hold that Dallas School District No. 2's carefully crafted student safety plan seeks to avoid discrimination and ensure the safety and well-being of transgender students," end quote. The appeals court added that the district's policy does not violate students' constitutional rights nor a law that protects people from discrimination based on sex in education programs. Nancy Hawk, executive director of Basic Rights Oregon, said the court, quote, "has done the right thing all around, following the law that allows transgender students the right to use the bathroom or locker room that most closely aligns with their gender identity. This simple act provides a more supportive and affirming learning environment." Similar lawsuits have also been dismissed by courts in other parts of the country.
A national animal rights group has sent a letter to the Clackamas County District Attorney asking that allegations of abuse at a Canby slaughterhouse be investigated. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, known as PETA, is requesting that Clackamas County District Attorney John Foote investigate reports that Mark's Meat cruelly mistreated several animals at its processing plant in Canby, Oregon, in 2018, 2019, and just last month. The incidents were detailed in reports direct from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Those reports describe a recent incident on January 29th where workers shot a pig who was squealing in pain in the head three times before she was rendered unconscious. Other incidents include a cow, a lamb, and multiple hogs who were shot in some cases up to six times and suffered for several minutes before they died. Mark's Meats is the animal processing facility of Revel Meat Company in Molina, Oregon. The company claims to sell, quote, "humanely processed meats and is certified organic as well as animal welfare certified." Their website says they implement, quote, "one of the most robust, systematic approaches to the humane handling of livestock," end quote. PETA is also asking that if the reports prove to be true, that criminal animal cruelty charges be filed against the plant and the workers involved in the incidents.
The trial of Jeremy Christian, who is charged with the fatal stabbing of two men and the serious wounding of a third aboard a MAX train in northeast Portland, continues this week. In May of 2017, Christian stabbed the three men after he had targeted two teenage girls on the train, one wearing a hijab, and began yelling racist and offensive slurs. Christian claims he was acting in self-defense when he stabbed the fellow passengers, 53-year-old Ricky Best, 23-year-old Talishan Namke Meche, and Micah Fletcher, then 21. Fletcher is the only one who survived the attack. On Wednesday, Christian told the court he will not be exercising his right to testify in the trial. Christian said he spoke to his attorneys the night before, but he alone made the final decision not to take the witness stand. Christian did not give a specific reason as to why he would not testify, but previously, during jury selection, he had said that he believes he is going to prison. Christian's lawyer said they have one more expert witness to call to the stand, and then they plan to rest their case. Prosecutors will spend at least one additional day questioning rebuttal experts. Christian is facing multiple charges, including first-degree murder, first-degree attempted murder, and second-degree intimidation, which is a hate crime in Oregon.
An audit published by the City of Portland shows mixed results for the investments into the Lentz neighborhood since 2000. The city has invested about $207 million into the Lentz neighborhood since 2000 to help revitalize the area, jumpstart commercial development, and create more housing and jobs. Property values rose by 63% since 2000, while 476 affordable housing units have been added in the neighborhood. The number of jobs in the area increased by 36% since 2003. Although jobs have increased, average wages, when adjusted for inflation, decreased by 4% between 2003 and 2017 to around $37,600. In comparison, the city average wage went up by 8% to about $61,400. The report shows that 3 out of 5 households that rent in Lentz spend more than 30% of their income on housing, which is higher than Montevilla as well as citywide. The audit said that 23% of residents in Lentz live in poverty, which is also worse than in Montevilla as well as citywide.
Lawmakers in Washington State are considering a bill that would regulate water rights sales to water banks. KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has more on the story.
Washington state lawmakers are taking up an issue that has vexed western states for decades, how to manage water resources. They want to tackle water speculation, which is squeezing some users. The concern is mostly about who owns water banks, which collect water rights from landowners and sell access to customers. At the Washington State Association of Counties, Policy Director Paul Jewell said there isn't widespread abuse of the banking system, but there have been some instances of what he called mini-monopolies and price gouging for domestic use of water.
We have other examples where we're seeing out-of-state buyers are coming into the state speculating on water rights and purchasing them with the idea that they would stockpile them and repurpose them for another use at some later date at a high profit.
Lawmakers began focusing on the issue after a Seattle Times investigation last year found a New York investment firm buying up water rights in central and eastern Washington. Among the bills being considered is Senate Bill 6494, which would regulate water rights sales to water banks. Jewell said the issue will need more focus after the short session is done, and he hopes the state will look at how other western states are dealing with it. He added there are some promising provisions under consideration. Senate Bill 6494 includes transparency requirements that he says could be especially useful for governments, farmers, and tribes.
Having the ability for people who are interested to easily find information and to be notified about how water resources are being used or being changed within their region, within their river basin, within their watershed, etc., I think is very valuable.
He said he believes there are many good uses for the current water banking system, but he thinks it needs some tweaking.
What we're concerned about are the uses that maybe aren't in the best interest of the public and of the resource, and we're seeing some of those occur. We just think our current system is too wide open for potential abuse, and so we're looking to address that.
This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Public News Service.
Another candidate has entered the race for mayor of Portland. Piper Crowell announced her entrance to the race this week. Crowell is Nike's director of global digital and innovation policy. She previously worked as an environmental activist, a congressional staffer, and a lobbyist for the music streaming company Pandora before moving to Oregon to join Nike in 2017. Her campaign manager, Paige Richardson, is known for orchestrating a big win for the Portland Clean Energy Fund in 2018. When asked by the Willamette Week how she disagrees with Mayor Ted Wheeler, Crowell responded, quote, "I have not agreed with his handling, especially this weekend of protests. I think there's more oversight he can do to make sure our police department is treating people with respect," end quote. Crowell is one of 13 challengers to Mayor Wheeler. However, only one, Sarah Iannarone, has qualified for public campaign financing. Anti-gun violence activist Teresa Rayford and architect Ozzy Gonzalez are currently the only other challengers actively campaigning.
Attorney General William Barr stepped in to reduce the sentence proposed by his own department's prosecutors for Trump's associate, Roger Stone. Prosecutors had requested that Stone serve 7 to 9 years behind bars following his November conviction on 7 counts, including lying to Congress, witness tampering, and impeding the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. After the department released a memo cutting the proposed sentence, all 4 federal prosecutors resigned from the case, one resigning completely from the Justice Department. A couple days ago, Trump fired 2 officials who had testified against him, and yesterday withdrew the nomination of Jesse Liu, a former U.S. attorney in Washington whose office prosecuted Stone. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, "We are seeing the behavior of a man who has contempt for the rule of law beginning to try out the new, unrestrained power conferred on him by 52 Republican senators." Attorney General Barr has agreed to testify next month before the House Judicial Committee, one of the key committees in the recent impeachment process.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be increasing clouds, patchy fog, a 30% chance of rain, and a low of 38. Tomorrow's weather will go from foggy to cloudy with a 70% rain chance and a high of 46. Today in history, in 1909, a group that included African-American leaders such as W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells Barnett founded the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. The quote of the day is from musician Al Jarreau, who died on this day in 2017. He said, quote, "Once you discover that you can, then you must, and it's not easy. You have to take direct steps. You really have to count your blessings, and you have to make a decided effort to not get seduced by the blues."
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won the New Hampshire primary, with former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg just points behind. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar was a strong third, getting more votes than former VP Joe Biden and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren combined. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump. With victories behind us, popular vote in Iowa and the victory here tonight, we're going to Nevada, we're going to South Carolina.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won yesterday's New Hampshire primary, but former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg was only points behind, the same two led in Iowa. But upcoming Nevada and South Carolina, with much more diverse populations, could yield different results. Entrepreneur Tom Steyer, Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, and former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick will be calculating their chances going forward. As soon as the New Hampshire polls closed, businessman Andrew Yang and Colorado Senator Michael Bennett dropped out of the race. The big surprise was Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who won a strong third place. She spoke to one of voters' top concerns, electability.
Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mudslinging, have someone to vote for in November.
Combined, former Vice President Joe Biden and neighboring Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren got fewer votes than Klobuchar.
I also want to congratulate my friend and colleague Amy Klobuchar for showing just how wrong the pundits can be when they count a woman out.
Turnout was up from 2016, and exit polls showed over half the voters decided in the last few days. New Hampshire election officials were feeling relieved. After the delayed and confusing results from Iowa last week, Mark Dindorf is an election official in Hart's location, one of the small New Hampshire towns that vote at midnight.
All eyes were on New Hampshire, and, you know, we can't have the sort of situation that happened in Iowa. And so there were, I think, preventative measures taken. You know, we didn't have an app that failed either. So although some larger towns vote with machines, you know, in Hart's location, and the smaller towns were voting on paper ballots.
While President Donald Trump had an easy victory in the Republican primary, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld took 9% in what many consider to be a protest vote. Four federal prosecutors resigned yesterday after Attorney General William Barr took the extremely unusual step of interfering in an active legal case to recommend reducing the sentence of former Trump aide and convicted felon Roger Stone. Warren talked about it last night in New Hampshire.
On a day when career prosecutors showed more backbone than almost every Republican senator standing up to this president, Americans of all political stripes are gravely concerned about the corruption of a Trump Justice Department that abandons the rule of law.
In Congress, Senate Democrats brought three top priority election security bills to the floor, but each was blocked by a single Republican senator. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A comprehensive bill that aims to tackle the plastic crisis in the U.S. has been unveiled. Senator Tom Udall, a Democrat from New Mexico, and Representative Alan Lowenthal, a Democrat from California, have introduced the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act of 2020. The bill includes several groundbreaking components to address the root cause of the plastic crisis on a national level. The bill would require plastic producers to take responsibility for their waste by essentially shifting the burden of waste collection and management from local governments and taxpayers to the manufacturers of items like packaging, containers, and paper. These manufacturers would have to design and fund these new recycling systems. It would also establish a nationwide beverage container refund system. The bill suggests that anyone buying a beverage container of any type be charged a 10-cent fee that would be refunded when they return the empty container. The bill would also phase out most single-use plastics, such as plastic bags, polystyrene containers, and plastic cutlery. It would also require products to be manufactured with increasing percentages of recycled material. For example, plastic bottles would be mandated to be made of 25% recycled material by 2025 and 80% by 2040. Lastly, the bill would prohibit the U.S. from shipping waste to countries that are not part of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It would also pause the permit granting process for facilities that manufacture plastic for 3 years so the Environmental Protection Agency can update its safe air and water standards. The new bill has widespread support from environmental groups, but is expected to meet intense resistance from the plastics industry.
A South Dakota court is taking a closer look at jurisdiction issues on Native American land. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In January 2017, two agents from the South Dakota Division of Criminal Investigation went onto the Pine Ridge Reservation to investigate a crime committed off the reservation. They were accompanied by a Bureau of Indian Affairs agent. One of the state agents spoke with the suspect. A Sixth Circuit state judge threw out the statement, saying DCI lacked authority in Indian country. Now the South Dakota Supreme Court will decide the issue before the case continues. Victoria Wicks reports.
Morgan Cummings was 18 years old when DCI agent Dane Rasmussen knocked on his door and asked to speak with him. Cummings made statements about the crimes Rasmussen was investigating and was eventually charged and prosecuted. Leading up to trial, the defense attorney asked that Cummings' statements be suppressed, and the trial judge agreed. The state appealed that decision. During oral arguments, Assistant Attorney General Stacey Hagee says Rasmussen employed a knock-and-talk method of making contact with Cummings, something any ordinary citizen has the implied license to do. Hagee says the trial judge erred by considering Agent Rasmussen to be a law enforcement officer rather than a member of the public. The defense says Rasmussen and the other DCI agent were acting as law officers when they arrived in police cars and questioned a suspect. Attorney Terry Pachota says the only way to right the wrong is to suppress Cummings' statement.
We cannot dispute the fact that at the time that this occurred, the state law was that they did not have any jurisdiction in Indian country. You can call it a knock and talk, implied license, whatever the state calls it, it doesn't make any difference. They did not have any authority there.
Picciotto says there is no justification for the agent's actions, even if they didn't know they were acting contrary to law, as the state suggests. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Tribal leaders from across the country are in Washington, D.C. this week discussing priorities at the National Congress of American Indians winter session. NCAI President Fawn Sharp delivered the State of Indian Nations earlier this week, which included a focus on climate change. Vaughn Golden has more.
President Sharp did not hold back, calling out federal lawmakers on what she and others see as inaction on climate change.
When it comes to climate change and sustaining humanity on this planet, we have no time left to lose, and yet our government is nowhere to be found.
She said her home in Washington State, the Quinault Nation, has already been forced to higher ground from sea level rise, and other attendees at her address are feeling the effects too. Sam Schimmel grew up on St. Lawrence Island off the coast of Alaska.
You're watching language disappearing as a result of weather patterns. You're seeing changes in weather, meaning that traditional practices aren't able to be pursued. And that's something that is having severe negative effects on the mental health and well-being of tribal communities across Alaska and across the U.S.
Schimmel, he's only 19 years old, but he participates in NCAI's Climate Action Task Force, and he's been a regular in lawmakers' offices over the issue. In Washington, Vaughn Golden, National Native News.
President Trump's task force on missing and murdered American Indians and Alaska Natives is holding a tribal listening session Wednesday in Washington, D.C. As leaders are in the area for the National Congress of American Indian session, the task force is reviewing cold cases and seeking ways to improve investigations and information sharing when it comes to missing persons cases. Some Native women's advocates and Congresswoman Deb Haaland are critical of the task force for its lack of tribal leaders and community members. The seven members are all from federal agencies. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Two dead dolphins with gunshot or stab wounds have been found on the Florida coast in recent weeks. Federal authorities are offering a reward for information about whoever killed the animals. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric